Okay, welcome to lecture three. So last time we used a single lecture to introduce all the very basic programming model concepts of CUDA, right? So today what I'm going to do is I'm going to put it together and take you through a very simple matrix multiplication example and exercise all the simple features, basic features that we talked about last time. And after class, you should go right away to log on to your AC cluster account. And many of you already have the account. So for those of you who have used the account, you probably don't need to do it right away. But for those of you who have not used the AC accounts in the past, you should try your account right away. If you have any issues, you need to let us know. And we still have quite a few account passwords and logins to pass out after class. So make sure that you follow the direction of MP0. Try the...
MP0 is kind of irrelevant. It was created back when the real SDK was not actually available. So there's a different set of instructions for how you set up your stuff on the AC cluster.
So start with MP1 right away?
Yeah.
Okay. And MP1 still uses the emulator?
No, MP1 we can run on the real hardware now.
Okay. So just follow the instructions. And we should probably change the website for the MP0 kind of stuff.
I did.
Ah, thank you. Hey, John is always one step ahead of me. So remember, in the future, when you do things for your advisor, follow his example. Okay, just always be one step ahead of your advisor. Your life shall be good. I will tell you a story about advisors next time. There's a story I always tell about these advisors. So let's go through the simple example. So it's a it's a matrix multiplication. In fact, to be more specific, it's a matrix multiplication, and you also have matrix vector multiplication. We're going to use a fairly simple example to just illustrate the basic features. So we will talk about memory a little bit. It will exercise the memory features. It will exercise the threading features. But we're not going to talk about shared memory usage until later. We're actually going to talk a little bit about local variables and local registers. Okay, and this is a very important concept for CUDA. We're going to exercise the thread ID usage. Okay, so we're going to also show you how the memory data transfer actually works in a real situation, and then we assume square matrix just for simplicity. You can do all kinds of rectangular by doing more coding, but we're just trying to keep everything very simple and very concise so that they can fit on a single slide. So just a very quick review. All of you have taken linear algebra, I believe, and so matrix multiplication should be a piece of cake here. But just to make sure that we're talking about the same thing, we will have two input matrix, N on the the left lower left hand and the N on the upper right hand. And so in order to generate one element of the result, you will take one row of N and one column of N, and you will do a inner product, meaning that you will do pairwise multiplication and you sum up all the pairs, right? So it's a very simple algorithm, and the complexity or the computation, amount of computation that you will be doing is what we call the N-cube algorithm, because you will have N squared, the number of elements per dimension. You will have square of the dimension of in terms of number of elements to generate, and then you will do the number of multiplications. For each element, you will do the same number of multiplications as the dimension. So that's where the cube comes in, right? So you have N, you have dimension square of elements to generate, and for each element you will have dimension number of multiplications to do, and you will also need to add them up. So that gives you that extra dimension. So when you multiply all these together, it's dimension cube, right? Number of operations. And in fact, it's dimension cube of multiplication and add. Okay, so that's what we call the multiplication accumulate. Okay. So before we go into the code, there's one thing that I always want to make sure that I remind you. It's called the memory layout for C versus memory layout for Fortran. And a lot of you have been writing Fortran programs, so you know what, just want to make sure that you know we touch on this before we go into the code. So when we have a matrix in C, we do what we call the row major layout. Okay. So what happens is that you will take these rows in the matrix, and you will lay out the matrix elements consecutively within a row. So that first row, zeroth row, is going to be laid out consecutively in memory, right? And then you have the second row to follow, the third row to follow, and the fourth row to follow. This is actually opposite to Fortran layout. Okay, so you know what, just for many of you, this in the past, people would tell me that, oh, I wish you reminded us beforehand. Okay, so here we go, okay? So why is this important? The reason is, remember, we're going to actually take a row of n, okay? And a column of what? N, right? So when we take a row of n, we are going to be, you know, accessing memory sequentially. But when we take that column of n, what we're really doing, let's say if we took the column 2 of n, we're going to actually be accessing the elements by doing hops in memory. Okay? So we are going to be jumping. And this is what we call the strided access. And you're going to see that in the code. Okay? It's a little bit subtle, but you know what? It's also going to have some very interesting implications when we start to care about performance. So you know, I want to make sure that you know all of us are solid on this, right? Before we move up. Okay, so row major layout. Let's start to talk to look at a very simple piece of code on the CPU. By the way, nobody writes real matrix multiplication code this way on the CPU either. Okay, so this is a very, very simple-minded piece of code, and it's going to be to run it with terrible performance on the CPU. Okay, so you know, but we're going to get into you know more subtleties later on. So let's just first talk about you know a very simple-minded way of doing matrix multiplication on the CPU, a sequential way. So we call this function, we name this function matrix mul host. So just to emphasize that you know this the actual multiplication is going to be done on the CPU host processor. It's going to be a single-threaded program, and what it's going to do is it's actually going to have to alter two levels of loops to essentially iterate through all the result elements of P. Okay, so every combination of the alter two levels of loop will give you one element. So by looping through those two levels, you will eventually generate all the elements of P, right? And within the loop, there is an innermost loop that does the inner product, okay? That's going to actually generate the result for one P element. And the way this loop works is that it's going to actually take one of the indices from the outermost loop and one of the indices from the inner loop, right? So this, it gives you, you know, the particular I and J, the you know, what indices, index for the particular P that you're accessing. So the outer loop index combination gives you the particular, you know, element that you're producing. And in order to produce the value of this element, you're going to have to somehow use I and J, and then there is an inner loop, you know, a variable K that you're going to increment so that you will walk through the row and the column sequentially to do the inner product. And so what we're going to see here is M is going to be accessed on a row basis, right? So you should be expecting to see some kind of address calculation that goes through the sequential. Remember, the M is going to be laid out. The M elements are going to be sequential because it's within a row, right? This is a row major access. So what you're seeing here is you will first use I, and you figure out which outer loop iteration it is, and you use I to go all the way over to the beginning of the row in memory. And this is why you multiply I by the width, okay, by the width of your matrix, because you need to hop over so many rows from the beginning of the matrix to the beginning of that row. So that's why it's I times width. And then you also want to get to the beginning of the column of N. And it's actually quite easy. It's just J. Because remember, it's a row major layout, so what you're going to do is to get to the very beginning of the column, you only have to skip over a small number of elements. And the number of elements is actually J. However, when you move within the row and the column, the movement is very simple for row because you just use the inner loop element K, variable K, and this K is going to be incremented by 1 in every innermost loop iteration. However, for N, you're going to actually effectively doing the strided access, right? Remember that hopping in the memory. So that's why K is going to be multiplied by width. So when K increments from 0 to 1, you're really adding a whole width to the index. And then 1 to 2, you add another width, right? So you're doing the hopping, you know, in the memory. So by using the outer loop index, and when you loop through it, you will exercise from 0 to width for I, you will exercise from 0 to width for J, and you have all these combinations, and as a result, you will have all the combined combination of I and J you need to generate all the elements of P, right? And within each combination, you will do this inner loop calculation, and you will position yourself in the right row and column, and you know, in the end, you'll produce the right inner product for that element. So this is, you know, well, all very basic stuff. And if you have taken a C programming language and a programming course, it's, you know, well, you should pretty much, you know, well, be very efficient about this. There's one kind of an interesting point here. You know, we declare a little, a variable. In C, this is called automatic variable, or sometimes we call local variable. And this variable is going to be, you know what, overwritten again and again and again for all the combination of iterations of the outer loop. Every time you come into a new element, you're going to override that sum with zero, and then you do the accumulation, right? And after you're done, you know what, you're going to write into the memory location, and then you go back to the next, you know, outer loop combination, and you initialize it again, and you do it. So there's only one sum variable that will be reinitialized every time you start to generate result for a new P element, okay? And that is going to change when we start to look at the parallel CUDA kernel. So a very typical way of generating, porting code from CPU to CUDA. Oh, there's one more point I forgot to mention. You know what? This matrix multiplication routine typically will assume that it's being called, right, by some kind of, you know, some kind of main program or something that does something else. And matrix multiplication is just one of the libraries. It's one of the primitive libraries that people often use. So you will assume that you have already allocated memory for M and N and P, you know, by the caller. So in the caller function, you would have already initialized the array, the matrix and all that stuff. But you're just passing the pointers, okay, the pointers to those, you know what, to the two input, and you will allocate output data structure, which is an output P array, and then you will also pass in the pointer to that output P array. So all will remain pretty much the same for the moment when you move the code into a device execution. So we're going to call this piece of code now matrix mall on device. But you know what? Essentially, it emphasizes the fact that the eventual multiplication would actually be done on some kind of device such as GPU. And the way we will, and this function is still going to be called, okay, by whoever was calling that original matrix multiplication. But once you get into the code, you no longer see that nested loop and all that stuff. But you see what we call the stop code, okay? That is setting up the execution or transfer data to the GPU and so on, that you would, you will really be doing the preparation work to set up an execution by the GPU. You are no longer directly doing the, the multiplication directly. So once you get into this, the matrix multiplication, you will immediately start to see some interesting, code. And this code is really just to, to set up the GPU execution. And remember, we talked about CUDA malloc, right? So we still assume that M and N are input matrices that have been already been allocated by the caller, and they already initialized. But what we need to do here is to actually allocate the space on the GPU memory now, okay, in the GPU memory space, so that we can transfer what user provided to you in M and N into the GPU memory space. So we will allocate something called MD device and ND, and they will have the same size as the M and N, and so that we can actually do the man copy from M to ND and N to ND, so that we can actually, have the data to reside in the GPU memory space. So this this also illustrates what I was talking about last time, where when we allocate CUDA memory, we do get a memory pointer back, which is MD, okay? But this MD is an address into the GPU memory. And if the CPU tries to use the address for anything other than, supplying that address into the CUDA mCopy, if you actually try to access that variable on the CPU, bad things happen, okay? And for those of you who have read A Fish Out of Water, bad things happen, okay? And in the end, you know what happened, all right? So if you don't know what happened, go online and search for A Fish Out of Water, and then and then see how big fish can get if you do things that you're not supposed to do. Okay, so once we allocated memory, we copied the CPU memory content into the GPU so then we are ready to do the multiplication as far as inputs are concerned. But then we also need to make sure that we have some space set aside on the GPU. So this is to allocate that, the P equivalent array on the GPU. So we will just allocate the space and get ready for the multiplication. So far, all that code was still executed on the CPU. Okay, remember, this function replaces the original matrix multiplication function on the CPU, okay? And so all that code was still executed on the CPU. And now, once we finish all that preparation, we're ready to invoke the kernel. The kernel function is your entry into the GPU execution, okay? And so once you invoke the kernel, you are in the parallel execution mode. And we're going to come back to this point, okay? And after you finish the kernel execution, you will typically also need to copy your data back into the CPU space so that the rest of the CPU code can make use of the data that you generated on the GPU. So this CUDA main copy after the kernel execution will copy the data back from P device into P, and after this, you are all set. You have, you know, essentially you have completed the equivalent functionality of matrix multiplication with the original code. So this is usually, a lot of people call this stub code or wrapper code, meaning that you have additional code before and after this kernel so that you maintain the same interface or the same behavior as far as the color of the matrix multiplication is concerned. And this is a very clean way for someone to yank out something that, you know, they use frequently on the CPU and produce a piece of code on the GPU and then produce all these, you know, interfacing and data copying and so on around it, so that you maintain that exactly the same behavior. And then after you're done, you know, it will be nice for you to just, you know, free the MD and ND and PD on the device so that you can reclaim that space for something else. So any question about what you need to do on the host code? So this should illustrate some of the APIs that we talked about last time, right? Okay, good. So that's step three. And we're on slide eight. Now we're ready to actually write the kernel function, okay? That's the entryway into the parallel execution. So as we mentioned before, the function will be preceded by this keyword, global. Okay, and global means what? Global means that, you know, the function that you're declaring is a kernel function. It's going to be executed on the device, but it's going to be called from the host. Okay, so the host can actually invoke this function. And we are going to actually have MD, ND, and PD. All these pointers will be passed into this kernel function. Remember, we already did a mem copy by now to initialize MD and ND. So MD and ND are ready for you to use. They have all that data inside. And you know what? MD and ND are also just, remember, addresses into the GPU space. So the host is using those two pointers, but the host is just supplying that pointer to a kernel that will eventually use it, okay? It will still have that width so that you will know the dimensions of the matrices. These are the main changes that, you know, you're going to see in that, from the original matrix multiplication function to the kernel function declaration. And once you go into the kernel, remember, this kernel replaces two things. One is, you know what, remember those two outermost loops, right? The I's and J's? The kernel replaces those with threading, okay? So we're going to invoke this kernel in a way that there will be many, many different instances of this function executed on the GPU, okay? So let's say if we have a 16 by 16 matrix, we're going to actually just invoke the kernel in a way that there will be 16 by 16, which is 256 dynamic instances of that function executing. And every one will be executing for one of the original I and J combinations. So by moving from the GPU code into kernel, we actually will take away two levels, the outer two levels of the loop. So you're not going to see the explicit loops anymore for those two levels. And then within the kernel code, we're going to be specifying that innermost loop. And that innermost loop will be executing under the assumption that the thread ID will tell it which original I and J combination that, you know, this particular instance is responsible for, or this particular thread is responsible for. Okay, so once we get into this, you know, the kernel, we're going to see a p-value variable, and this variable is actually a what we call the thread local variable, and it is the equivalent of C automatic variable. However, there's something subtle about it that you really have to remember. This particular variable is going to be replicated, okay, for each thread. So each thread is going to have its own version of that local variable. If you have 256 threads, you're going to have 256 different versions of that P all active at the same time. And this chip is capable of executing thousands of threads. And if you have thousands of threads, you're going to have thousands of copies of that variable all active on that same chip. Okay. So when you use a local variable, remember, it is actually a very expensive proposition in some way, right? Every time you use one of these, you need to multiply the storage by the number of threads that you're going to be, you're going to be invoking, right? So there, just beware of this, okay? And then, now we're ready to, to finish the kernel by, rewriting that innermost loop. Remember that innermost loop will take one row of n and one column of n, and do the multiplication. So instead of doing I and j, remember we're replacing I and j with the thread IDs now, okay? And so the thread IDs will have the x and y dimensions, okay? So we're going to actually use a two-dimensional thread system, and the thread IDs will have access to the x component and y component of the thread ID. And all these the range of these x and y components depend on how you call the kernel. So it's actually determined by the time you actually call the kernel, what you supply into the invocation, and we're going to see that very soon. So in this particular case, we're going to just use the thread IDs. We can define the thread ID so that the thread ID x will give me the x dimensional or the horizontal dimension index, the index in the horizontal direction, and the y ID component is going to give me the vertical index, the dimension index. So I can use the x component as the x dimension index and y component as the vertical dimension index to determine which p I'm going to generate. So if you look into the code, you're going to see that I'm going to actually use thread ID y. So the thread ID y tells me which row I'm going to be accessing in M, right? So you're going to see thread ID y multiplied by y, and that gives you the beginning of the row, okay, in N. And then you're going to also see for N, you're going to just use the thread ID x to find the beginning of the column. Okay, so these two truly just replaces the I and J, right, in the original CPU code. Now, you still need to loop through the elements in the row and column. So every time you increment the K, that K is going to be multiplied by width for as far as N is concerned, but K is simply going to be used to walk through the row, okay? So if you look at the code, you say, ha, what's the takeaway is, as long as I assign the thread IDs in exactly the same way that I and J will be, to assume the role of I and J in the original CPU code when it comes to the array accesses, then, I can have a very simple mapping from the CPU code to the GPU code. And this is what I was referring to earlier about the multi-dimension, thread IDs. They are really designed to simplify your programming effort. So, this is kind of a good illustration of these multi-dimensional thread IDs and how you can actually use them to replace the loop indices in the original CPU code. And after you're done with the dot product multiplication, then you can write your variable into the particular P element. So this is really the calculation of the exact location of the element that you're supposed to be writing to. So, you know what, by doing the calculation on the, in the local variable and eventually write the local variable into the P array, you essentially have the ability to, to avoid doing the memory access in every pair of add, multiply and add. And you can just do the calculation in the local variable and then eventually do the address calculation and write it into that global memory. So this, you should assume that there will be many, many, many threads, okay, all doing the same thing but on different P elements. Okay? So that leads us to the next step. Now we can actually invoke that kernel function. When we invoke the kernel function, we can do a very simple-minded invocation. So this piece of code only uses the thread ID, okay? And if you remember from last time, I did talk about the thread organization as a two-level organization. There are blocks, there are threads within the blocks. So for this piece of code, we actually only have the concept of threads. We didn't really introduce the concept of block into the piece of code. So you can probably envision that there's no way for these threads to realize which block they belong to, right? You have to write the code that way. So that's the cost of this simple piece of code. Because it doesn't write the concept of block IDs into the code, you really cannot distinguish between blocks, so we're going to just declare that there's only one block. Okay, we're going to only use one block for that particular piece of code. And then within that one block, we're going to declare that the block is actually a two-dimensional block, okay? And each dimension has width elements. So when we call the kernel, remember we actually supply the thread organization when we call the kernel. So this is, we're going to supply the dim grid and the dim block into the kernel invocation with the three lower less sign and the three greater sign in between the name of the function and the actual parameters. So by calling the kernel function with pre-initialized dimensions, so let's say if we have 16, if the width is 16, then we are going to actually create a single block, okay, a single block of threads. And these threads are going to be arranged in a 16 by 16 two-dimensional way. And then every thread ID, so those 256 threads are going to have unique thread ID combinations, right? X will vary from 0 through 15. Y component will vary from 0 through 15. So you're going to have all the possible combinations of thread IDs in your kernel execution. You're going to have 256 instances all executing as threads. And each one will have a unique combination of thread ID, and each one will be accessing a unique location in P, right? You will access a unique combination of row and column, so they're all doing their own work. Does that make sense? So that's how a simple matrix multiplication can be written. However, there's some clear limitations of with writing code that way. The most important limitation is now you're only using one thread block in your matrix multiplication, and one block of threads, means that back up a little bit, and each thread is going to have to load one row of AMD and one column of ND. And if you look at the matrix multiplication on slide 11, what happens when we calculate the particular p element on that slide, you know what, we're using one entire row and one entire column to calculate that particular element. And if you look at the calculation of the element to the left of that element, then you know we're using the same row, right? We're going to be using the same row to calculate with a different columning n. So the way we wrote the code, the calculation, you know, the thread that's calculating 48 and the thread that's calculating the neighbor element, they will both go to memory, they will both fetch an entire row from n, okay, the same row, okay? And there's a little bit of waste here, right? You know, they both use exactly the same row of n, but they will each individually go and fetch, okay? So there's no economy of sharing here and in that simple piece of code. And that's, you know, essentially what this, you know, what this the text is saying. You're going to, for every thread, it's going to load a whole row of nd and whole column of nd, and it will do the multiply and addition of each pair of these elements. So if you think about it, you know, we can start to define a concept called the computation to memory access ratio. Okay, this is the time to start to, you know, to get this concept in. What that means is, for every memory access, how many compute steps you will be doing for the memory you just fetched. And unfortunately, the memory accesses in these modern processors, whether you're on a CPU, whether you're on a GPU, these memory accesses tend to be very, very expensive. Every time you go to a DRAM, you are spending hundreds of clock cycles, okay? And more importantly, you can only get so many of these data elements through per clock, per second, okay? So if you exceeded those limits, you will be totally limited by the memory access, you know, what capacity or the bandwidth. So in this particular case, you will be accessing one M element or one N element, okay? And you will do one multiplication and one addition. So you'll be doing two compute operations per two memory accesses, and that's 1:1. On this chip, you know, on the GPUs today, if you have a 1:1, you're going to get absolutely lousy performance, okay? And if you're on a CPU today, if you have a 1:1, you also get lousy performance, okay? So we're going to actually spend some time dealing with this issue, a lot of time, in fact, okay? So, but this is at least the beginning, so that I want to make sure that you build up your, you know, some of these terminologies and, you know, concepts over time. And this is one of the things that you really need to make sure that, you know, the concept is very simple, but make sure that it's very clear so that you can, you know what, calculate these things very quickly as we go down the lectures. So, but one of the interesting limitations, you know, that we're going to have to overcome right away is that the size of the matrix is actually limited by the number of threads you can have in a thread block. You know, remember, you know, we're only using one thread block, right? So, you know what, because we're using one thread per element for calculating that P array, we can only generate as big a P array as the number of threads we can fit into a block, okay? So if we can have, you know what, let's say only up to 512, okay, threads, which is the case in CUDA today, then we can only accommodate up to 512 threads. And for square matrix multiplication, that means you can have up to 16 by 16, that's 256 already. If you go up to 32 by 32, that gives you what? 1,024, that exceeds the number of threads you can have in the thread block. So by using only threads within a single block to do this simple matrix multiplication, we just limited ourselves to a very small matrix, which is a bad, bad, bad limitation for devices, because we need to have thousands of threads in order to actually fully utilize, right, the device. And you know what? Limited, being limited to 256 threads for this application is not going to be, you know, to do that trick. So obviously we will need to be able to, you know, to actually use thread blocks so that we can handle much, much bigger matrices. And that's the, you know, arbitrary size, and we're going to actually talk about that very, very soon. The idea is you should start to have two-dimensional thread organizations. You're going to declare two-dimensional blocks, okay? And within each block, you know, you're going to actually have two-dimensional threads. So we're going to use blocks to cover what we call the tiles of P, okay? So that for each particular thread block, it's going to just cover a window, okay, or a panel of the P matrix. And within that panel, we could have up to 16 by 16 threads, right? So by doing this hierarchical approach, we will be able to, you know, to use the thread ID and the block ID to determine the memory accesses, so that we will be able to zoom into the right P element and fetch the right M and N elements for calculating that P element. So, you know, we're going to first use the tile width, and in this case, it's going to be up to 16, and we'll compute tile width square of the submatrix, or what we call a tile of the matrix. And we are also going to, on top of it, generate this two-dimensional grid of blocks. And the number of blocks that we will need to have in each dimension is really the original width of the array divided by the tile width. So this gives you the number of tiles that you need to have on each, in each dimension. So you would be, need to generate the square of number of tiles so that you have enough blocks to cover all the P elements. In the end, you may have a matrix that is still bigger than the number of blocks that you could have. Each one is, you know, 64K minus one. So if you have truly have huge, huge, huge matrices, you can still run out of, you know, a number of blocks that you can use to cover the output. So in that case, you will need to essentially write an outer loop, okay, that, you know, that would actually loop through these two-dimensional block structures, but you know what, you would have to segment out the output so that you will have a segment that will fit into the number of blocks, and then you generate all those P arrays, and then you loop sequentially to the next one, and you do this. Another possibility is you can use multiple GPUs, and you know what, hopefully we'll add a little bit of material about how to use these multiple GPUs to implement. So that will be covered very soon, but before we cover that, we're going to actually talk a little bit about some useful information on the tools, because you're going to be starting your lab assignments today. So just, you know, we'll give you some quick overview so that when you read the documentation and assignment, things will make sense. So the first thing you're going to do is you're going to have to write that piece of code, and you're going to actually compile that piece of code. So you know what, when you use these tools, there's a little bit of a conceptual background that you need to keep in mind, and we actually talk about this real quick, but you know what, I think it makes sense to review that a little bit. You're going to be writing a piece of CUDA code, okay, and you know what, so you're going to have these, you know, CU files, and you know these files, hopefully we'll have, you know, some kind of kernel function there. You'll have, you know, you'll have the main function, and you have, you know, data declared, with CUDA keywords and so on. So, when you have these, you know, CUDA files, you're going to use MVCC, essentially NVIDIA C compiler, to compile that extended C, you know, C syntax. And you know what, all the host functions, all the host data will be essentially extracted out and then fed into the host compiler, and in the Linux world is, you know, typically GCC. And you know, in some cases, you could also use the Intel compiler to compile. So you know what? Then all the kernel functions and device functions and the data declared on the device will be also separated out and fed into the rest of the MVCC compiler, which is based on for those of you who like these things, it's based on the Open64 compiler infrastructure, and then you would be fed in what generates something called PTX. It's parallel thread execution, okay, PTX format. And this is essentially the equivalent of Java bytecode, okay, for GPUs. And this piece of code is going to actually look, fairly similar to assembly code, but it's, it's not the final code. It's just like Java bytecode. At runtime, something is going to take the bytecode and generate what? And do a, like just-in-time compilation or, something like interpretation. And something similar does happen to that piece of, to the PTX code on the GPUs, okay? And so at runtime, you're going to actually have a little just-in-time compiler that will take PTX and generate the particular code for G80 or G280 and anything else that you're going to be using to execute. So this piece of code gives you a very good indication of at the lower level what's going to happen, because it's essentially something very close to the machine level code, but it's not necessarily the final answer. So there will be a little bit difference. The runtime is going to do some further translation, but hopefully the translation is minor enough that most of the real major performance issues will be exposed when you just look at the PTX code. And NVIDIA is not going to expose the detailed machine code to you. And the reason is actually very simple. They don't want to overexpose all the architecture details so that your code is going to be too dependent on the particular architecture configuration or features. So they want to make sure that every time they introduce a new product, they have a reasonably portable machine code that they can retarget. Okay, for example, registers. For those of you who are in the EC and CS world, from one generation to the next generation, they may well increase the number of registers available on that machine. So if you have done all the final register allocation assignment on in the PTX code, it will be awfully, awfully hard to use the additional registers. Okay, so that's why the real register allocation assignment is actually done by the runtime and rather than the generation of PTX. So it will be hard for you to get a totally accurate count of the number of registers used at runtime by just looking at PTX. These are trade-offs. If you want some nice portability, some features, sometimes you have to relinquish a little bit of precise measurement and precise control. Did you want to add anything, John?
Only thing I'll add is that there are some tools out there that you can actually disassemble the real ISA that it finally gets compiled down to, so you can actually look at how your registers are being used there.
Should we encourage them to do that?
Why not?
Okay, then just be careful when you make those assumptions. Okay, so this is just a quick summary. The next slide, 15, is a summary of what I just said, so that you can look at them after class. Linking, all the executables with CUDA code require two dynamic libraries. One is the runtime library, CUDA RT, and then equivalent to the C runtime library, CRT. And the other one is the CUDA core library that gives more of the mathematics and so on, and the intrinsics and so on. Okay, debugging. Do we really want to talk about emulation anymore?
It's reasonable. I don't There is a CUDA debugger of some kind available now. I haven't looked into it in depth to figure out what it's good for, what its limitations are. I do know that if you compile and run in device emulation mode, it makes debugging a whole lot easier, especially for your device code.
So,
but I don't know exactly what support's in there now that was not there before.
Maybe let's do a little bit of a high-level introduction, next week.
Okay.
So let me talk about emulation versus real hardware execution. At some point you probably will find it easier to debug your code with some emulation mode. So this emulation mode is actually supported entirely in software, and when you compile your CUDA kernel. Okay, and when you compile your CUDA program, if you compile it with device emulation mode, which is minus device EMU, it runs completely on the host using the CUDA runtime. So, you remember there's memory data transfer to the GPU, there's memory allocation on the GPU, and there's kernel execution, and these threads, right? All these things will actually be emulated totally by software, okay, on the CPU. So when you think you're allocating memory on the GPU, it will actually become a memory allocation on the CPU. When you think you're transferring data from the CPU to the GPU, under emulation, you will be just moving copying data from one part of the CPU memory to another part of the CPU memory. And when you think you're executing a huge number of threads simultaneously, you'll be executing a huge number of threads sequentially. Okay, so that gives you, interesting way of looking into the memory space. So, originally this emulation mode was, designed so that, for some of the very early developers that may not have GPU access. So at least, these people can develop a few small applications and learn CUDA and so on, waiting for the GPUs. But GPUs are so common today. In fact, what John and I kind of just, had this little exchange at the beginning of the lecture reflects that, that change of mentality. In the old days, a lot of people would, use emulator because they, GPU access may be hard. But when we set up this course, for this semester, we make the GPU available to you right away. So the incentive of developing, some of your applications on an emulator has, reduced in that sense. And so when you run in the device emulation mode, you can do a few cool things. Yes.
So when you run in the emulation mode, so how can we synchronize
it? So when you synchronize the threads, you remember this is emulation, right? So all the threads are So let's say if you generated 16 threads, and they all have some kind of sync thread execution. So what happens is on the CPU, you're executing these threads sequentially, but as soon as one of the threads hit that synchronization, you will be put away, and then it will take in the next thread until all the threads reach that synchronization point, and then you move on. Okay, so all this is actually done on a by a scheduler that will you will be executing most likely one thread at a time, but you will actually do this kind of switching to make sure that the original semantics of the synchronization is maintained. Any addition? Yeah. Okay. So one thing is you can use the thread native debugging support, like a GDB kind of support to set breakpoints, inspection, and so on. And I believe the GPU hardware has increased the level of support for GDB kind of functionality. So that's what John was referring to. We'll try to give you a little bit of overview next week on how to use the debuggers on the with the real hardware. But you know what, at least for the first couple of generations of CUDA, you know what, the having full debugger support on the emulation mode is actually quite helpful, because that maintains some of the programmer, you know what, the features that the programmers have been used to, you know what, in the CPU world. And you can access any device-specific data from the host code and vice versa. So what this means is that, you know what, let's say if you're calculating something in the CUDA kernel, right? In the real execution, until you copy the data back to the CPU, you cannot access that data, right? However, if you're running on the emulation mode, you can actually, you know, write a little piece of code after certain steps of your kernel, and without copying data back and forth, you can actually look into, you know, the data structure. So you can, you know, write some inspection code or something that, you know, will be more conveniently accessed rather than constantly having to shovel data back before you can inspect that data, right? And you can call any host function from device code. So for example, that printf, you cannot call printf from device code when you execute on the GPUs. But many of us are used to writing, you know, putting a printf into the loops or into some of these portions of the code to actually, you know, try to see what the values are, right? So this allows us to, you know, actually go back to our old habit of, you know, using some printf functions, you know, when we try to debug some GPU code, right? And hopefully we get the logic right before we, you know, remove the printf and then, you know, ship the code back into the GPU. And we can also detect some, you know, deadlock situations caused by improper usage of the sync threads, because, you know, it does maintain that semantic, right? So if we have some kind of a deadlock situation or something that, you know, something wrong with that various synchronization, you know, it's easier for us to be able to have a breakpoint and then say, hey, are we making progress? And, you know, are there, you know, threats that are waiting for things that just not going to happen? Okay, but there are also some potential pitfalls that you really need to remember when you execute, you know, code in emulation mode. The first one is the emulated device threads actually are executed sequentially. So what this means is that if your code is not properly synchronized, okay, let's say if your code has a situation where, you know, between synchronization points, two threads are writing to the same location, or one thread is writing to a location, another thread is reading from that location, then suddenly, depending on the timing, one may write before the other one can write or read. So depending on the timing, you may have non-deterministic execution results. When you move that code to the emulation mode, because these things are always going to be executed sequentially, you know, you will be generating only one possibility. You're not going to see the other possibility, right? So that will not help you to expose some of these very timing-dependent, improperly synchronized bugs. Okay, so you need to keep that in mind. And another thing is, you can get really, really high, and you can start to do all kinds of funky things in your code, in your emulation mode, and forget about it. That is, you may be writing some of this inspection code, right, and peeking into the GPU data structure from the host code, and then you got so happy about it that you started to write your main logic and so on, you know, using your GPU variables, and then don't remember that, right? And it will work okay on the emulation mode, but as soon as you move it back to the GPU, you're going to get some very bad behavior, okay? You're going to start to have some bad results, and sometimes even unpredictable results. So you need to be very disciplined and only peek into the GPU space from the host when you really are trying to just debug and do some inspection, rather than, you know, incorporating those things into the main logic of your code. Floating point. We're actually going to have a whole lecture about this. Okay, you know what? There are all kinds of what we call the precision and accuracy kind of concepts that, you know, we found out over the years that we really need to, you know, systematically go through it. But at this point, you need to remember the accuracy and the precision of, you know, what CPUs and GPUs can still differ. Okay, there's still going to be some differences. And the differences are actually shrinking, by the way. You know, every generation of GPU is getting, you know, more and more, you know, accurate and more precise and closer to the CPU, but there's still going to be some subtle differences. And when you execute a code on the CPU and emulate the code on CPU, you are going to see some difference in floating point behavior. This oftentimes has to do with compilers. Okay, you will be compiling with the host compiler rather than the NVIDIA compiler, and you're going to have some instruction set differences. Double precision versus single precision, and you're going to have MMX versus, you know, versus the single precision GPU. So these, well, I'm throwing those terms at you not because you need to fully understand those. I just want to make sure that for some of you who really want to, you know, follow through with some more studies, you can actually look into those. But it's really optional. So when you, oftentimes on the CPUs, when you execute a multiply and add instruction, the intermediate result of that multiplication is actually maintained in what we call the extended precision mode. It actually uses even more number of bits to represent the floating point number in the middle of that computation. But in the GPUs, you know, it doesn't happen for various reasons. And it may well happen in the future, but you know what? You would begin to see some of these things creep into the, you know, into the result. But you're going to see, you know, why the numerical results don't agree. That doesn't mean that you have a bug in the code. It just means that oftentimes you do have some minor differences in these kind of, you know, floating point behavior. So, you know what? I'm going to take you through a few more things, especially to help you to finish the two-dimensional thread usage of the matrix multiplication, so that you'll be totally ready for, you know what, for the MP. So let's go back and take a look at the, you know, the thread organization here. And you know what, the picture that we're showing here is, you know what, every kernel is going to, you know, when the kernel is invoked, it's going to create, you know, a grid of threads. And the grid of thread is fundamentally a two-dimensional organization. You're going to have thread blocks, and you can have one-dimensional thread blocks or two-dimensional thread blocks. And it's up to you to define the dimensions. So remember the dimension data structure that you supply to the kernel invocation determines that. So it's really up to you to decide, you know, whether you want to use one dimension or two dimension, and how big each dimension will be in your thread organization. And within each block, you can have up to three dimensions of thread. And the three dimensions are X, Y, Z components. And you, again, you know what I'm showing here is just a, you know what, 4x2x2 three-dimensional organization. So it is up to you to define exactly what you want to do. And you know what, the availability of these multi-dimensional index organizations allows you to, you know, adapt your thread organization to the original what? Loop organization, okay, in your code. Okay. And that's essentially, if you have a three-level, you know, loop in your original code, chances are you will end up using some kind of three-dimensional thread data structure, and that will naturally allow you to map your thread ID into, loop ID into thread ID. So let's go back to, you know, to the matrix multiplication, and as we mentioned, we're going to actually use the thread blocks to calculate a tile of the output matrix. So, you know what, by defining the size of these tiles, we can actually fit the amount of calculation that we need to do to the number of threads we can afford to have in each block. So what we need to do is we need to actually do two things. One is we need to use both the block ID and the thread ID to identify the right row and the right column, okay, from M and N. And the other one is we need to use both the thread ID and the block ID to identify the particular data element that we're going to use. So you can, you can just think about this as, there are, sections of a street, and then within each section you have the street address, right? So you will have section one, section two, section zero, section one, section two of the street, and then within, so that's the block ID. And then you have, the thread ID within the section that's, that gives you the thread. So let's say if we're going to, to calculate this, the P element on the in this picture. So what we're going to do is we're going to actually have to use the block ID to, to move our address into the right tile, and then we use the thread ID within the block to actually reach the element within that section. Okay, and you should be seeing this in the code. And to give you a very simple example, let's say if you have a small example of 16 elements in the 4x4 matrix, then what we do is we will use we can actually use a 2x2 block structure, and within each block we have a 2x2 thread structure, right? So whenever we're going to execute for thread calculate P22, what we need to do is we need to figure out that, I'm in block one rather than block zero, right? So that will move us to the beginning of the tile. And then I am the thread zero, okay? So that gives me this particular element, okay? So, when we calculate a particular tile, we will use the tile as the block ID to make sure that we get to the particular section of the rows and the particular section of the columns, and then we would do the inner product and write into the output. So you leading into this code, so what we're going to do is we're going to actually identify the row for each thread now, right? So when you come into a thread now, you're going to identify the right row and the right column that you're going to be working on. The correct row for you to work on is by taking the block ID, okay, of Y, thread Y ID, and multiply by the size of the tile, the section size, to move you to the right section. And then you will add the thread ID to it to get you to the particular row within that section, right? And you will do the column calculation of M by using the same thing. You will have use the block ID X times the tile width, and then you go in add the thread ID X. So there's nothing really fancy about this. It's just purely in terms of the sections, and then you zoom into the section and you use the thread ID to get into the correct entry. So we still will use a local variable P, and then within the innermost loop, what we're going to do is we're actually going to use the row to access MD. So the row will be multiplied by the width, and then you advance that the access by incrementing this K, and then for MD you're going to actually have the correct column, but then you're going to advance the result access by multiplying K with the width. Okay, the width is original matrix width. Okay, so there's a tile width here and there's a matrix width here. So make sure that you go through it with a simple example, and that's the real reason why I gave you the simple example. When you look at this code, make sure you go back to the simple example, you know, work it through and make sure that you really, really are comfortable with it before you start to debug your code. So this goes back into, you know, let me loop back. This, you have seen this slide, at the beginning last time. So, you know what, by this time it should make a lot more sense to you. You know, CUDA thread block is really a collection of threads, okay? And you can organize threads within the block in one dimension, two dimensions, and three dimensions, okay? But fundamentally, you cannot use more than 512 threads within a block. And this number is unlikely going to change because the way scaling works in CUDA is not by increasing the number of threads in a block, but it allows people to increase the number of blocks using these applications. Okay, that's I remember someone asked about scaling, and it may not make a lot of sense to some of you, but it really doesn't have to make a whole lot of sense until until this point. So I'm going to actually come back to this this point. Momentarily, or next time, depending on how much time we have. So, so you could have a one-dimensional block of anywhere between one thread and 512 threads, okay, in one dimension. You can have a two-dimensional block, and you can have as long as the product of the two dimensions does not exceed 512, and three dimensions same way. The threads all have thread ID numbers, and these thread ID numbers now should be very clear to you. They are within the block, right? They're unique within the block. But different threads across different blocks can actually have the same thread ID, and you really have to use block ID to distinguish between those threads, right? And you know what? So the thread program uses the thread ID to select the work and the address of your data structure, okay? And that's really, the key to what we call the data parallel processing. You have essentially the same kind of code, but they all know how to work on different parts of the data structure. Threads in the same block share data and synchronize. So this is going to be one of the things you're going to complain again and again and again, so I may as well tell you up front, you're going to be complaining about this. The threads in a block can have very effective data sharing. They can synchronize with each other with barrier synchronization very nicely. But threads across blocks don't have any easy way of synchronizing with each other. So you're going to be working on some applications where you're going to be scratching your head and say, why do they not give me a synchronization primitive across these blocks? And it's because of the scaling, okay? And it was a trade-off that they have to make, and I'm going to actually come back to this thing a couple of times in the future. So you have to assume that each block can execute in any order relative to others. Your algorithm cannot depend on the fact that a particular block will execute before another block. You have to assume that they can execute in any arbitrary order, and your program logic should make it correct. If you really want to make sure that there's some kind of order, you need to terminate your kernel, okay? And then invoke another kernel if you want to enforce any kind of order in between thread blocks. So why is this? It's because the way the GPUs scale their performance depends on the fact that they can build what we call the narrower devices. In this case, you may have just a small number of those execution, what the SMPs, the streaming multiprocessors, or you can build a chip that has a large number of those multiprocessors. Okay, and it's already happening. If you look at the laptop version of the G80, series, these laptop versions would typically come with only two SMPs, okay? Whereas the cards that you'll be using from the AC server will have 16 SMPs on the chip. Why is that? Because you know the laptop chips need to be power efficient, need to be very, you know, conserving in terms of power consumption, and they can only afford to put in a small number of SMPs and then you know fit into the power budget. Whereas you know some of these super gaming you know kind of situation, you know people even you know put four of those GPUs into a you know into a dry ice cool box, right? And they, you know, some of these gamers expect that, you know, that will also work, right? And you know, so the same CUDA code that you write will execute all the way from those two SMP-based laptop chips to a super duper gamer configuration with multiple, you know, multiple GPUs in the future. And you know, so the only way to make it work that the main thing that may make it work in this architecture is that when you generate all these blocks in your CUDA code, you will be the hardware has the freedom to execute two blocks at a time on a small configuration and a lot more blocks at a time in a larger configuration. And you also need to make sure that when these blocks finish, they can finish in arbitrary order so that they can actually, you know, get worked through as quickly as possible. So with those two requirements, essentially you will need to have the, you know, the option of executing, you know, a large number or a small number of those blocks at the same time, and as a result, you will end up with all kinds of possible ordering, right? So you know what? In order for this to work, your code cannot assume that block zero will always execute before block three. Because in this situation, block zero will not execute before block three, right? And that allows you to do that scaling effectively. Yes?
So I have a question about scalability.
Yeah.
So if you run the code in laptop, GPU,
yeah.
So and run with the AC, so how the memory access is scheduling, how the memory, because for each block you need to
Later, because you know, I would need to actually talk about shared memory before I answer that question. So you know what, if you really want to know now, come to me after class. But you know what, I will be talking about when we talk about shared memory. So now we're at 10 till. So what we're going to do is to finish up the on Thursday to finish up the execution of thread blocks. And I'm actually going to begin to give you a little bit sense of how these threads actually execute on the SMPs, so that, but not in great detail, but just enough of sense of reality, so that you can begin to argue and begin to articulate about some of the constraints, so that the constraints will make sense to you. So I'll see you all on Thursday.
All right.